In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what you can see in the sky at this time of year. And we welcome back to the program a friend of ours who's been with us here many times, Jim Kaler. He's a professor of astronomy at University of Illinois, and we will be talking about some of the things that you can see in the sky this time of year. We like to do this fairly regularly because, of course, things change, and there are different things to be seen with each season. And we want to give you the opportunity to ask questions, and you can do that very easily here by just picking up the telephone and calling us in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here.
Thank
we
you.
Do have a caller already, so
goodness.
Why don't we go ahead and talk with them,
yeah.
And then we can do our little tour of the sky and
okay.
See what else is on people's minds. First caller here is in Urbana, line number one.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank
mm-hmm.
you. I'm calling because my wife was watching a nature program the other day, and it was talking about conditions on the Earth maybe a few hundred million years ago when the days were shorter, I guess, and the moon was closer to the Earth. And the question came up is just what do we think now about the origin of the moon as a satellite of the Earth? When I was reading about this, there wasn't really any well-accepted explanation of how it all got started, and I wondered if there'd been any consensus forming since.
Pretty much. There's still controversy. There's always controversy about any theory, but the only one that still seems to make sense as a collision theory, that the planets and the rest of the solar system were built out of the accumulation of what amounted to dust grains in the early solar system just after the sun was born into small bodies and increasingly larger bodies, fewer and fewer of them. And the latter ones accumulated by collision, which should have been pretty violent. And you can see the effects of that on the moon. You can look at the man in the moon, for example, these spots which are lava-filled impact basins, which some of which could have come very close to breaking the moon in half. You can see the same effects on Mars, huge impact basins on Mercury. All the planets that have a preserved surface have these massive impact basins. And the accepted theory is that the Earth, primitive Earth, just after it was formed, was hit by a glancing blow by a body about the size of Mars. And the two to some degree merged, and the rest of it, which lost much of its volatiles, the lighter elements, went in orbit about the Earth and accumulated into the planet. This is the only theory we've got that explains chemical composition of the moon and its orbit and just about everything else. Although, you know, there's still people who say this is sort of ad hoc and you can't really prove it. No, you can't, but there's sure a lot of evidence for massive collisions of this sort.
Right. And then during this collision, I'd guess that a lot of material would just be lost back into the solar system.
Probably, but that didn't went into the gaseous material and solids went into orbit around the Earth and reaccumulated back into the moon. The moon then very gradually moves away from the Earth. This is a result of the tides it raises in the Earth. It's sort of a feedback mechanism. And you can actually measure that. The people with precise atomic clocks can see this practically on a day-to-day basis almost. The result is that the day lengthens by about a thousandth of a second per century, which, because clocks are cumulative, factors into having to put an extra second in the day about once a year.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Other questions are welcome. All you need to do is call us, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. And we do also have a toll-free line. If it would be a long-distance call for you, that's 800-222-9455. Well, lately I think folks have been talking a lot about Mars.
You could sum it up in one word. That's right.
That's it. Mars is the thing that people are excited about because now, do I remember this right, that it is now the closest to the Earth that it has been in a long time?
It has been in many years. It can get closer than this, but not too terribly much. I think the next apparition will be slightly closer, but this is a really good set of observing sequences. A planet comes into visibility about once every 2 years. It's the lapping time between Earth and slower-moving Mars. And it gets very bright very quickly. It's fading a little bit now, but you hardly even notice that. It's just gloriously beautiful there in the southeast in the early evening. Mars is also, unfortunately for those of us who live up here, about as far south as it can possibly get. So the view isn't, well, it's not nice with the naked eye. The telescopic view could be better because you're looking through all that air because Mars is so low on the horizon. Mm. And that makes the telescopic view a little bit bad. Where you really need to see it is down there in the southern hemisphere, Tropic of Capricorn, down in those, where it's practically overhead, and you get a spectacular view of it. When you do find Mars, don't confuse it with the star next to it. If you look to the right of Mars, there's a bright reddish star called Antares. It's not as bright as Mars, but the two are in really neat juxtaposition because the name Antares means like Mars because the colors are similar. It comes from the word Ares, which is the Greek version of the god of war, Mars, which is the Latin version. And it's kind of nice to see the two together. You really compare the colors. Mars is not quite as red as Antares, at least to my eye.
But Mars does have a reddish tinge to it.
Oh, yeah. That's why it's named Mars, after the god of war, blood and all that. It's very noticeably reddish, especially if you see it next to a normal whitish star. The color really jumps out at you. Mm. It's the result of iron in the soil, and there are a couple of theories for how it got there. It could be just rust from the atmosphere. There's a new one about infall of iron meteorites, which over the years has colored the surface.
If you have a telescope and you have an opportunity to look at Mars that way, can you see some of the surface features? Can see
I mean, looking at Mars in a telescope from Earth is sort of akin to looking at the moon with a naked eye. That's about the level of resolution you get. But even with a relatively small telescope, you can see a polar cap. You can see some dark markings, a dark rock where the dust has been blown away by winds. And if you are willing to wait, you can watch the rotation of the planet. The planet spins about once a day. It's a little over a 24-hour period, very much like the Earth. So you can see things come in and out of view. With high-quality instruments with a good seeing, amateur astronomers can even do such things as map weather patterns on the planet.
Very good. And can you see the moons of Mars, or are they too faint?
That's very difficult. It's been done with amateur-sized telescopes, but they're not very big. They're only a few miles across, and they're just big rocks. They were discovered with a 26-inch professional telescope, the Naval Observatory, in the last century. I mean, that's the kind of equipment that it really takes to see them to advantage. Skilled observers can see them with smaller instruments, but it's not a backyard sort of view. They're really not what you call natural satellites. Not that they're artificial, but they seem to have been captured by Mars rather than have formed with the planet, although there's argument about that too.
Yeah. So there were big rocks that just happened to be flying by and got caught by the gravity?
Yeah, the problem is how to catch them. That's difficult. They don't just get caught. You've got to slow them down. Two bodies don't catch one another. You've got to have a third body or something to get in the way, and how that happened is simply not known.
We have other callers. Let's talk with someone in Eureka. Line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Recently they launched a satellite called MAP, and I'm wondering, could you tell us a little bit about what it will be doing? Will it be getting any chemical composition?
MAPS?
Yeah.
Well, I think you stuck me. Is that the one they're using to look for the background ripples in the Big Bang radiation?
Yes, it'll orbit a million miles from Earth.
Yeah, I think that's the one. And
radio signals primarily.
I may be wrong. I think this is one of the many satellites in which you're looking for what the details in what's called the cosmic background radiation, which is radiation from the Big Bang. It's all around you. It's a very cold radiation. And it has slight ripples in it, and there's all over the sky. It's not entirely uniform, and an examination of these ripples begins to tell you something about how the universe and the galaxies we have were created. It's going to be some time before there are any results from it, however.
Okay, well, I hope that gets at the
Thank
question
you.
Of the call. Let's go on to line number 1. Someone here, I think, on the campus. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Hi, I'm calling from the UI Astronomical Society, and I just want to let listeners know that our monthly open house is this Friday.
Oh, great.
9 o'clock. So, if you want to catch a view of Mars.
Oh, this is great. Thank you very much. This is really neat. We've got the historic 12-inch telescope, which will be on Mars. What are you guys seeing?
We are able to make out the... I shouldn't say canals. I know that's the term they use historically. some of them on Mars, and it depends largely on the atmospheric conditions.
Yeah.
But yeah, and a few people claim they can see the polar caps. So we're a little skeptical. It might just be variations in color, but yeah, we can make out a lot. It looks pretty nice.
Okay, good. Yeah, I see. I saw the polar caps once in a 3-inch telescope. It doesn't, if you got the right one and the bigger one, you can do it. A word about these canals, these linear features. Many of them were discovered, of course, to be optical illusions and not there. But there are a couple of features that the Valles Marineris, for example, that can be seen from the Earth. It takes pretty good seeing to do it. But you can see surface features on the planet, no question about it, even with a relatively small telescope.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was some of the sky around Mars. I know if people get fed up with looking at Mars. We spent the whole month looking at it down at the observatory, and I was going to say the sky around Mars is kind of rich in star clusters, so we're going to try and take a look at some of those this Friday.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
So before you go, tell us when and where.
Yeah, it's the observatory on the south end of the quad next to Smith Music Hall. July 6th, it's this Friday, from 9 p.m. till midnight, probably a little later. And if you want to receive email about open houses, you can write to the Astronomical Society at uias@uiuc.edu.
Okay, that's great.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Other questions are welcome. 333-WILO.
A compliment, the Astronomy Club. We've got a venerable Astronomy Club at the university. It's been around for, I don't know when it got started, but it long predates me, and I got here in 64. And they've done a beautiful job of taking care of the old instrument and running open houses every month. It's a really fine organization. Anybody in town gets an interest in astronomy. We've got two good astronomy clubs in town. CUBE's Astronomy Club, which you can access through Parkland College, and the UIUC Astronomy Club.
Okay. And the questions are welcome. If you want to call in here, talk with our guest, Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at U of I. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit about Mars. Besides Mars, what is there that you can see?
Oh, well, Venus. You got to look at
Venus and Mars.
Early morning. If you're an early riser and you're out there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, Venus is absolutely beautiful at this time of year. And it's going to make, next week, it'll make a very close approach to Saturn. In Saturn, star Aldebaran will all be in a little triangle. It's a very pretty sight to watch these colored lights in the sky. Now, this doesn't mean that they're physically close. They're separated in three dimensions by a lot. Saturn's a lot farther away than Venus. But they sort of pass each other. And if you've never seen Saturn, you can't miss Venus. Believe me, it's the brightest thing out there. And you see Saturn just very close to it. Mm-hmm. And Jupiter way down to the horizon. You've got out in the farms, you've got a great eastern horizon. You can just see it coming up before sunrise.
I was looking at a book the other day, and I think we may be talking to this author, and it's a book that's about common things that people believe about the universe and about stars and things that aren't correct. And one of the things that it was included was a kind of a astronomy trivia quiz. And one of the questions was, what is the hottest planet? And I'm sure most people would say, well, it's got to be Mercury, because Mercury is closest to the sun. But in fact,
it's Venus. Yeah. Not by much. And then it depends on whether you want to use average temperature or what. The sub-sun point on Mercury is approximately as hot as Venus. Not quite, but very, very close. But, of course, the nighttime side is really cold, so the average temperature is not all that great. Venus, on the other hand, is hot everywhere, even on the nighttime side. It's like, you know, the sun goes down in these I won't use last night when the temperature went down, I think, to 40 below, didn't it? At least it felt like it. But, you know, in your typical August evening, the sun goes down and it really doesn't cool off that much because of the trapping by the Earth's atmosphere. And Venus's atmosphere is so thick that the trapping is effectively permanent. And even on the nighttime side, it's just as hot as it is on the daytime side. So globally, it's much hotter than Mercury.
Do we have now good surface maps of Venus? We know what it's like underneath
the clouds. You can't see anything through the clouds, of course, but optically, but they've done radar mapping. The Magellan spacecraft orbited Venus, I think, for 3 years, doing very detailed radar mapping. We know the features of the planet very, very well. It's different from the Earth. It's sort of all of a one-level planet. You don't have big basins. You don't have the high mountain, high continents. There aren't really any continents there. There are some high areas, that go up as high as Everest, but they're very small. But it's sort of a boring, uniform planet, except for the fact that there's huge numbers of volcanoes on it. There are volcanoes all over the place. Yeah, it's about 100,000 of them on the surface. It's a planet that has in the past been incredibly active volcanically, probably as a result of its proximity to the sun.
Hmm.
It gets more heat, softens the rocks, makes volcanism easier.
How is it that it has this atmosphere that it has? Does that also have to do with where it is?
It has to do with the fact that it's closer to the sun, yeah. And liquid water probably never had much of a chance because of the proximity. Even if the planet did have, even if you started it off with an ocean, it wouldn't last very long because of the evaporation of the water by sunlight. And water is a greenhouse gas. You get it in the atmosphere, and that drives the temperature up a little bit more. And you got a feedback effect. Higher the temperature, the more the evaporation, and pretty soon no water, and that means you can't incorporate carbon in the rocks, so you get carbon dioxide in the atmosphere rather than in rocks where we have it here, and that just raises the temperature even farther, and the whole thing is just a runaway oven. And the same thing would probably happen to the Earth. If you could take the Earth and tractor it into where Venus is, you'd probably get pretty much the same thing happening to us.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we're farther away.
We talked about Mars. We talked about Venus. Are there some other things that you tell people to look for?
Well, summertime, of course, is great when the weather clears and the humidity drops down. Take a look at the Milky Way. A little bit later in the morning, midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, it's going pretty much overhead. This beautiful band of starlight, just combined light of the stars of the galaxy. It's a very attractive time of year. Mars is pretty much within the middle of the Milky Way. In fact, as the fellow from the Astronomy Club said, there's lots of things around Mars for a telescope to see. Clusters, nebulae, all kinds of things that involve the Milky Way.
Hmm. Last night would have been a good night because the dew point dropped down significantly.
Well, that's the problem. It gets so humid and the atmosphere gets murky and it gets hard to see things close to the horizon, and especially when you get some scattered lights from town on the humid air, your chances of seeing much of anything really go down pretty dramatically. Yeah. We want to see the sky really well. Go out to Starkle Planetarium Friday night to take a look at the show.
I would just happen to be looking at, knowing that you were coming, I was looking at, I think it was Sky and Telescope. And apparently there's a big controversy raging in San Diego where they're going to change their street lights and they're going to expecting the level of light pollution is going to jump up dramatically.
San Diego agreed years ago. It's an astronomical center. Palomar, after all, is not that far away from it. And we have our observatory there in back in the Laguna Mountains. We have 1 meter telescope we operate with San Diego State. And years ago, they perfectly nicely agreed to use low-pressure sodium lights. These give a little bit of an more orange color. You've seen them, perhaps in some towns, they're the long version of these yellow lights. They're about a foot long or so. And they radiate at specific wavelengths, and they don't pollute the sky as much. Whereas the high-pressure sodium just radiates all over the place. They're yellow. They radiate all over the place. It's a very bad choice for astronomy. And it's really sad to see San Diego doing that and destroying some of their astronomical culture.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that...
For no reason. That's the problem.
That I noticed was that apparently in Connecticut, it's the only state that actually has a law about light pollution.
That parts of Arizona do. Tucson does as well. Because of Kitt Peak National Observatory, which is economically important to them. And they've been extremely good about this. The sky brightness has only marginally increased in the Tucson area over the last 30 years, even though the city has grown dramatically, simply because there you have lights that go down where you want it rather than go up where you don't want it. And they've controlled it very well. You can do this with minimal cost. In fact, it probably saves you a lot of money. If you look at the satellite maps of the United States, it's brilliant in the East Coast. You can see all the traffic lights, used car dealer, all the lights shining up in the air where it's just totally wasted money, totally wasted oil, gas, resources.
Well, maybe we'll start... Was just thinking more about energy. Maybe we'll think a little bit more about that.
Yes, I hope we can, right.
Our guest here this morning is Jim Kaler. He's a professor of astronomy at University of Illinois. Every once in a while is here. We talk about what you can see in the sky. And if you have questions, you can call us. We have a caller here ready to go. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Oh, hi.
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know how long it takes a light to get here from the sun.
8 minutes.
8 minutes. Okay, how much long to take the light to get here from the moon? Of course, it's reflective.
About a second and a half.
A second and a half.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can see the moon's a lot closer than the sun by a long shot. That was interesting. It was interesting to listen to the... discussions The discussions between mission control and the astronauts when they're on the moon, because somebody would talk and there'd be this minimum 3-second delay in the time it took the radio signal to get to the moon, somebody to talk, and then get back again. You experience some of the same thing when you talk with via communication satellites. They're far enough away that you can get the effect of this delay of this light travel time, but it was really obvious on the moon. And you can imagine a discussion of your friend goes to Pluto or something, which is about 4 light hours away. And, you know, you say something at breakfast time. By dinner time, you get your answer back.
Okay, how long does it take the light to get here from the nearest star?
4.5 years.
Woo!
Yeah, that's Alpha Centauri. It's in the southern hemisphere. You can't see it from up here. It's the closest star. But a lot of the stars we see at night are a similar distance. There are a few that are few light years away, but you look at some of them, the star Deneb, for example, which is part of the summer triangle, nice bright star you see rising in the northeast, 1,500 light years away. It takes 1,500 years for light to get here from there. 1,500. 1,500. Far away.
And I have some more questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Do the planets, as they turn around, do they turn clockwise or counterclockwise?
They turn clockwise if you stand up above the north. You get way up far north and look down. Depends on which direction you're looking. Then they're going around counterclockwise. They all go in the same direction.
I'm confused now because I thought I heard you say both things. If you're standing up looking down at the north pole of the planet.
Now if you go north from the solar system, go way up to the north.
Yep. Oh, okay.
And then turn around and look back down again.
Uh-huh.
They're going counterclockwise.
Counterclockwise.
Okay.
Counterclockwise. Same direction in which the Earth rotates.
That's amazing.
Well, it's because everything started at once. It's not accidental at all. The whole system formed at one time, the sun and the planets from a spinning cloud, and everything's going in the same direction.
Well, now, when the moon goes around our Earth, does it turn around too?
Mm-hmm. Goes around counterclockwise, keeps one face pointed to the Earth. That's why you always see the man in the moon where he is, never changes its position. But with respect to the stars, the moon or the sun, the moon rotates once with respect to the sun every month, but it keeps one face pointed toward the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't spin relative to us. And that's due to tides. It's the same. It goes back to this first question we had today. Gravity of the moon raises tides in the Earth, and that is causing the Earth to slow down. But the moon is so small compared to the Earth did the number on the moon many years ago and simply locked it onto us so it doesn't rotate relative to us.
And one last question, if I can think of it. it's flown out of my head. Sorry.
It's okay.
That's okay. You can call back later if it occurs to you again.
Thanks a lot. Right.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay,
so just going back to this which way the planets turn question, everything is turning the same.
Yeah, there are some exceptions. Venus spins backwards. Nobody really knows why. I've heard a variety of theories. It could have to do with collisions. The small planets' rotations were probably set by collisions ages ago. Planet Uranus technically rotates backwards. It's tipped kind of upside on its side, and Pluto rotates backwards. But the others all spin in the counterclockwise direction like the Earth does. And they all orbit the sun, and almost all the satellites orbit their parent planets in the same direction. There are some exceptions. The captured ones, Jupiter's got a lot of captured satellites, and a few of those orbit backwards. But those are exceptions. Generally, everything goes around the same direction.
Could it just as well be the other way? Was this just a coin toss kind of a thing?
If you live in Australia, then it's the other direction. You know, it's the similarity of most. Sure, it could have all gone in the other direction, but then what we call clockwise is the direction in which the sun appears to go across the sky. That's why clocks go clockwise. They model the sun. So naturally, everything moves counterclockwise to make the sun go clockwise. If we'd been if the first people who invented clocks had been in Australia, your clocks go in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll take your word on
that
one. Don't
get me started on this stuff.
We'll just go on. We'll talk with a caller here in Belgium. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Like you all, I really enjoy looking at the night sky, but the real problem I've been finding anymore is to find some place that is dark.
It's not easy. I went out to do some photography the other night. Must have been a couple of weeks ago. and went down past Sidorus. I was like, Wally, I'm really going to get out of town, and found a real dark country road. And you know, what came out on those photographs were all the horizon was brilliantly lit with yard lamps and the like. It really is hard to find a place around here. I'm not quite sure where you go anymore. You can go down to Walnut State Park is probably about the darkest place in the area. It's where we used to have the telescope, and it's fairly isolated, and it's a little rolly, and there aren't quite so many farms with yard lights and so on. That's a 40-50 mile drive.
Well, I've found some fairly dark areas, but it's southwestern Indiana seems to be.
Yes, yeah. If you're willing to really get out of town, you can find it. But you know, within 20 miles of Champaign-Urbana, it's tough.
How does anybody up around the Chicago area? They just don't look at the stars.
Yeah, pretty much. There's a fellow up there that I know who does sidewalk astronomy, drags his telescope out in the middle of Chicago and shows people things. Uh-huh. You can do it, but what are you looking at? But bright planets and the moon and that sort of thing. But anything deep sky, forget it. You really have to get out of town. Even Yerkes Observatory, 90 miles away in Wisconsin, is heavily affected by Chicago light pollution.
Thank you very much. Oh, you're
welcome. Thank you. Next caller is Clifton, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Kaler.
Oh, you're welcome.
As a navigator in World War II, we had what we called HO charts, and for the life of me, I don't remember what HO stood for. Do you know?
I have no idea. Were you an ocean-going or air navigator?
United States Army Air Corps, sir.
Okay.
So we were flying up above, and... of course, the interesting facts is if you're at the equator and the sun is directly overhead.
It's tough to navigate on the sun when it's overhead.
It don't make any difference if it's a star or whatever. If you're at the equator and you've got a heavenly body directly overhead, 1 minute later it'll be 15 miles west overhead of the guy or gal that's 15 miles west of you.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing to do. Air navigation is tough. I think, celestial navigation began with ocean-going vessels, and, you know, we've got 5-10 minutes to make a calculation. How far does the darn thing go? You know, even if you're going at 10 knots, 15 knots. But an airplane, they had to modify the whole system. Sextants and... because the airplane moves fast in a very short period, long ways in a very short period of time.
Well, the B-24 bomber didn't move that fast.
Well, yeah, but it's faster. It's faster than a battleship. That's for sure.
Oh yeah. Well, I can. On our graduation mission, I hadn't even thought about that when I called you. But we had just occasional hole in the sky, and so I was shooting stars up there, and then I would have to wait maybe 6 minutes, maybe 7 or 8, and I was taking the LOP, the line of position, for my first fix, and just advancing for my airspeed and heading, and that gave me a good fix. But anyway, they calculate. What I wanted to ask you was, they calculate ahead, and it's amazing to me. God put these stars out there, and they stay in the same order. But they do change just a bit.
Well, this is the reason for the U.S. Naval Observatory, actually, is to measure very precise positions of stars and planets, especially, which can move quite a bit from night to night, and to keep up with it so that you guys who are navigating at sea or in the air could know exactly where they were and get yourself a good fix, and or line of position, as you call it, which is a line, discovered in the 19th century, it's a line on the Earth at which a star maintains a constant altitude as you move. Angle above the horizon. Get a fix on three of those, and bingo, you know exactly where you are.
Yeah, we were measuring what we called angles of elevation.
Right, exactly.
Up to the, and of course, when we plot these lines of position, they're part of a great big circle.
Right.
But
right.
But the circle's so big, you just plot it as a straight line.
Right.
But one I want to ask.
I had to bring you into my class sometime. Hey, you tell my kids about this. This is great stuff.
Hey, I'll be happy to.
It's nowadays, of course, you don't do that anymore. Now you just turn on the computer and get the signals from the global positioning system, and it'll nail you down within a 10-foot square.
Yeah, tell me about it. We took a flight to Scotland in November, and I went up. A pilot called me up. Well, I left my card with him, and he called me up to the cockpit. It was kind of interesting being up in the cabin. But they got the database there, and they just punch the coordinates in where they go, and the thing figures out. They don't need a navigator.
No, they've got these dozen satellites in orbit about the Earth with time signals. You can tell precisely where you are. However, how do you think they get the satellites up there, get them positioned, get them all in order? Of course, somebody has got to go and use the background stars to do it. So they just put a different layer between you and the stars. Still comes back to the stars, something I like to say.
Yeah. We had 27, I think it was 27, what we call navigational stars, and they had the charts on those.
Right.
And we had to use some of the navigational stars if we were going to do celestial. Otherwise, if you got another star, you didn't have the mathematics on it.
Right, but they were there. NAVAL keeps track of about 1,000 or more of them, and that you can use.
Of them?
Yeah, easy. More. There's 1,500 or so fundamental stars that can all be used for navigation if they set you up with it.
Yeah, I suppose.
And now, of course, to navigate things like the Hubble Space Telescope and the various other things that are going up there, NAVAL's putting out a new catalog of 50 million stars
50
with precise positions. Yeah.
Yeah. How many stars are there?
It's uncountable, literally uncountable. There's 200 billion in our galaxy alone, and you can't keep track of them all. And then you start looking at other galaxies, the number gets out of hand really fast.
The question, I never did get to my question I wanted to ask, which was how far ahead have they got these stars computed to?
You can predict their positions, thousands of years in advance pretty well. At least the nearby ones you can, where you know their motions precisely. But, of course, the observations are always ongoing to make sure you know exactly where they are.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that pretty well does it, but I'd be happy to come down and get a class down there.
Oh, once in a while. I'm not teaching it right now, but I do the background of celestial navigation in one class. It's kind of fun. There's a lot of fun to talk about, especially when you get into the old way it used to be done, and the need for it, and the danger of navigating without knowing where the stars are. I mean, a lot of people died because they didn't know where they were, and they didn't know where the vessel was, and they couldn't track their latitude and longitude.
So
thank you very much for bringing this up. This is great.
Well, it was a great experience, and I'm just glad I got home from the war. And it was interesting to listen to you. And if you want to get a hold of me, just call Tiger Miller at Clifton, Illinois.
Okay. Thank you,
Keep
sir.
Smiling.
All thank
right.
you.
Thanks
Fire
for your call.
Force.
We got another caller here. We'll talk with them. They're in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah. I thought of that question.
Okay.
Would you say something about the tilt of the Earth, how it's changed over the years, and what caused it and stuff like that?
The tilt of the Earth is probably produced again by early collision when the last days of formation. It's tilted over at 23.5 degrees from the vertical as defined by the orbit. So, and this is what gives you the seasons, because as the Earth goes around the sun alternately shines overhead in the southern hemisphere, then in the northern hemisphere, and the sun's higher, you get more heat. Highly concentrated heat, and it gets warmer. The tilt, as a technical name, is called the obliquity of the ecliptic, because it's the same angle by which the apparent path of the sun in the sky is tilted relative to the equator, which is what makes the sun appear to go back and forth across the equator. First day of summer near now, it's about as high in the sky as it gets. That angle does change. In fact, it's decreasing very slightly right now. It oscillates back and forth by about a degree, and that's a natural oscillation produced by the effects of the other planets on the Earth. Earth's orbit. The result is, it's kind of a cute result, is that the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn are both moving toward the equator right now. There's a monument to the Tropic of Cancer, which is where the sun gets overhead, it's the maximum limit, in Taiwan, which is now about a mile north of where the Tropic of Cancer actually is. So we're losing the tropics and we're losing the Arctics, and this has nothing to do with global warming or anything, because it's going to swing back after a few tens of thousands of years. It's a natural oscillation.
Okay.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, very good. Other questions are welcome, and we have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Jim Kaler. He's professor of astronomy at University of Illinois. We have questions about what's in the sky, what you can see there this time of year. You can call us 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. By the way, if you're interested in reading about astronomy, Jim has some books, and in fact, I think is the Little Book of Stars still the most recent?
No, there's another one that came about a few months after that. They're very different, discuss different things. The Little Book of Stars is a introductory book. You should be able to find it at most bookstores around here. And the other one that just came out is called Extreme Stars at the Edge of Creation. Really dramatic title on it. Brilliant orange cover on it. Really nice from Cambridge. So we got two of them floating around now.
And also, there's lots of astronomy information on the web. And one place you might go to see what's going on in the sky is the webpage of the U of I Astronomy Department, which is www.astro.uiuc.edu.
Yeah, and you can get on. There's a link there to Skylights right on the homepage of the astronomy department. You get in from there and give you a weekly update, and you can get to read all about the star of the week.
Yeah, and Jim writes this regular column on there, so if you're interested in stars, again, it will tell you about what it is and where it is and say some things about it. And there are also, I know there are links to other astronomy websites there, too. All right, very good. We suddenly are full with callers, so we'll just get right back to it. And the next person in line would be in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Is this too far afield a question to ask? But as the Earth wobbles on its axis, the precession every 26,000 years, has that been a significant factor or a major factor in the changing of ice ages and, you know, sometimes...
It's been thought to be so. It's a combination. These are called the Milankovitch cycles, and it's a combination of the precession, the wobble of the Earth's axis, which more or less maintains the 23.5-degree tilt. The small variations in the 23.5-degree tilt that, that we were talking about before. And I think it's a 40,000 or 100,000-year periodicity in the eccentricity of the elliptical orbit, plus minor changes in the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And you put all these together, and there's a suggestion that these have triggered ice ages in the past. I don't know how seriously it's taken. I don't think the ice ages seem to be triggered by something. It's not a sudden chilling or anything. But they have been related to orbital characteristics of the Earth, and that's really about all I can tell you. I don't know really where it stands at this point.
Okay, I missed the first part of the program, and so I hope this isn't a repeat.
No, sir.
Astronomical events or cycles that have influenced ice age rotation and the lifting of, now deserts had been formerly, quite...
Well, some of that has to do with people, too, chop down trees and get yourself a desert like the Sahara. There does seem to be some indication that changes in orbital parameters can trigger changes in the climate of the Earth. But then you have to factor in solar effects and all manner of different things. It's been very difficult to disentangle.
Okay, great. I had one other question, if I may.
Sure.
When's the last time Mars was 35 million miles from Earth? What year was that?
I don't know. It seems to rather miss it. It goes through this, 17-year cycle. Mars has an eccentric orbit, and when it's at opposition to the Sun, it gets close and then it doubles its distance because of it. Now we're close to it. Now, when the closest point was, I honestly can't recall. It did pretty well the last time around. Nearly 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it was pretty close. But when it hit the minimum, I can't remember.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, thank you. And for those of you who are keeping the score at home, our weather guy, Mike Sola, he was listening to the program, and he came in and handed me a note that says the HO stands for Hydrographic Office.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Hydrographic Office Charts.
Excellent. I should have known that.
Thank
Everybody
you very
says
much.
That after Mike. They hear it. Oh, of course.
Oh, of course. Let's continue. Let's go to Pontiac, line number four. Hello.
Hi. Hey, I might have missed it earlier. I was wondering what the planet was that you see in the sky now and how long it'll be there.
Oh, that's Mars. That's the bright one to the southeast as twilight ends. And that'll be with us all year long till well into next year, because the Earth is only slowly passing, and it seems to hang in the sky practically forever once we get past it like this.
Uh-huh.
So you'll see it for a long time. It'll gradually fade, but it'll still be brighter than the brightest star for some time to come.
Will there be other planets?
Well, you got Venus in the early morning, and Venus is passing by Saturn in a week or so, and you can use that to identify Saturn. Venus can't miss because it's so bright, and Jupiter's now just launching itself above the early morning horizon, too.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right, very good. So next we go to Pena, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've always been interested in the galaxies, and I know they've discovered new ones recently with new telescopes, but it's always been a question since I was a child. If you get beyond the last galaxy, what is out there, if anything?
Well,
and I know I'm asking a unanswerable question, but I thought I'd ask your comment anyway.
There is no last galaxy. That's probably the simplest way to put it, because that would imply that there would be an edge to something, so either they just keep going and going, and we can only see within the area, within the volume of space that's accessible by the speed of light. Once you get outside beyond that, the light hasn't reached us yet, so we don't know what's out there, but presumably it's something similar to what's here. And in addition, the gravity of the combined gravity of the galaxies may curve space and space-time to the point where it could even be closed in on itself, although that's not really believed. Well, some believe it, some don't. The mathematics of it is horribly difficult. But if really since Kepler's time, people have talked about the edge of the universe and the fact that there really can't be an edge. There is no edge. It's like there's no center. And that actually winds up simplifying things a little bit, believe it or not.
Well, see, this is what throws me.
Well, we talk about the visible edge of the universe, which is as far as you can see. It's a horizon, so to speak, but you don't know what's quite beyond it.
Over the hill.
That's right. That's right. Exactly
but
right.
This just mystifies me because everything we know is finite. We have a beginning and an end, and this leads to my belief in God that, gosh, if it's that big, somebody had to take care of it.
Well, that's a strongly held philosophical point of view by a lot of people. The universe does indeed seem to have had a beginning. Whether it has an end is problematic. It could go literally to infinity forever.
It still drives me over the nuts to
think about it. You're not alone.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you for the call. Back here to Urbana for someone else. Line 3. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a very interesting subject for me. I'm wondering, I hope this isn't too far off the subject, but what kind of efforts are being made to contact intelligent life?
Well, it's called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI. There are a number of centers that go after this. There's a big one in this country that I can't remember which radio telescopes they use off the top of my head. I know they have used the big Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico. The idea is to look, and I don't mean listen here, you're not hearing an audio signal, but to look for radio signals that have some kind of intelligence behind them, whether it's a communications beacon, somebody broadcasting to try to find somebody else or whatever. But there are a number of them. They've developed some spectacularly interesting radio techniques, broadband radio techniques for covering huge areas of spectrum at the same time. And, you know, we've got the technology. Given enough radiative power by another civilization, we've certainly got the technology to pick it up. So far, nobody's found anything, or of course it would have been splashed all over the news. But so far, nothing. We seem to be it so far. It doesn't mean there isn't anything out there, but a lot of people are interested in this subject.
All right. Is the U.S. government the leader on this?
No. In fact, the U.S. government backed off. NASA was giving $1 to $2 million a year toward the main program in California, which is operating out of California. Then a variety of congressmen said this is silly, and they cut off and made NASA cut off all the funds. So the government is out of it completely, except that it is allowed to use some of the government government-owned equipment, which isn't, you know, it's owned by subsidiaries, universities, and the like. But immediately, a variety of philanthropists threw in the same amount of money, so SETI just kept rolling along.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, thank you. And one more here, Geneva, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, you just had a caller a few minutes ago asking about the planets and where to see them. I just wanted to say that the Chicago Tribune on their weather page every day has a location guide and what time to look for planets.
Good, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very good. All right. Well, we're sort of coming down to it. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you about. I wanted to ask you about Comet Linear. I had been reading about this. Is this still something you can see?
Well, apparently it's reached naked eye brightness. That's about all I know about it. I haven't gotten out to look. I'll take a look myself. This Comet Linear is the second one to come along. The last one it broke up when it passed the sun. It just disintegrated, fell apart. It was quite a spectacular picture. Comets are not all that unusual. And fourth magnitude comets, they come along once in a while. This is probably not going to be another Hale-Bopp. Those are rare critters. Maybe once a generation you'll get one like that. But I can't tell you much about this. I haven't looked into this one very much.
Okay. And do you even know where?
No,
One should look for this.
Nope. Sorry. Okay. I did not get a chance to look that up.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll just take one more caller here on Interurbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm calling back from the Astronomical Society. You mentioned Comet Linear.
Oh, good.
We went out to the Dark Sky site last Saturday night. We were out till about 5 a.m., but we did spot Comet Linear.
Is it visible to the naked eye?
Well, there was so much light pollution to the east southeast out there that we really couldn't see it. But with binoculars,
you
fuzzy,
can. Okay.
Little fuzzy blur there.
Where is it?
East southeast sky in the constellation Cetus. It's moving into Pegasus.
Okay. So it'd be in the morning sky.
Yeah, probably 1:30, I'd say. But you have to wait for the moon to set, so.
It's not something you go out and you say, oh, what a beautiful comet.
Right. It
takes some trouble to be able
hey,
to
thank
say
you
that.
Very much.
Okay, yeah, I'll let you know.
All right, very good. Well, in that case, I guess we're
see
about
what a good astronomy club we have. You just throw it; they'll come right back with the
there,
answers.
Bang, they're there. Well, in that case, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you would like to do some stargazing, the astronomy club will be having their astronomy open house this coming Friday, July 6th, from 9 until midnight at the observatory on the
campus, the
edge of the quad, just back behind Follinger,
right near the Morrow Plots. Next to Smith Music Hall.
That's the place to go. And if you're interested in reading about astronomy, go to the bookstore or the library. You can look for some of the books that our guest, Jim Kaler, has written. And also, astronomy information is available at the website of the U of I Astronomy Department, which is www.astro.uiuc.edu. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Jim Kaler, he's professor of astronomy here at University of Illinois.